I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. If you're just now joining us and haven't had a chance to listen to our previous episode featuring the first part of my conversation with author and China expert Jim McGregor, let me bring you up to speed. Last episode found me on the ground in Shanghai during a record-breaking heat wave. I made my way to McGregor's apartment, and he greeted me with news that his air conditioner was on the blink.
Yeah, my air con, well, I had it on for the last 24 hours, so it's okay, but it can't keep up.
Yeah.
We sat down anyway, and among his vast array of China books and paraphernalia, we entered into a frank and informed appraisal of U.S.-China trade and its worrisome implications. No one might have predicted nearly three decades ago that China would rise to become the United States' single largest trading partner. And so it was that U.S. trade negotiators acquiesced on a number of trade conditions, believing the China market would prove a boon for U.S. product manufacturers. As it turned out, Americans became significantly bigger buyers of Chinese products than the other way around, hence today's major trade imbalance. What I find so interesting about this conundrum is that then, as well as now, the Western world underestimated the strength and determination of the Asian economies, and China in particular. It's a mess of our own making, and here's the irony. By advocating for free trade and open systems, Western economies effectively let the fox into the henhouse. Americans in particular have been sucker punched by their own wanton shadow. Consumerism is the engine of the U.S. economy, and in order to drive that consumption, U.S. companies were quick to shift manufacturing and jobs to a lower-cost base in China. In return, Americans were showered with a wide array of inexpensive Chinese-made products. From iPhones to auto parts, the mainland has become the world's preeminent manufacturing hub. If the initial enticement was low-cost manufacturing, the ultimate seduction appears to be a China market filled with 1.4 billion consumers, a market teeming with the world's fastest-growing middle class. China, so it appears, is the multinational's wet dream. It all comes with a catch. In light of China's preferential arrangement, U.S. multinationals wanting to sell to China must first partner with Chinese companies, adhere to technology transfer agreements, and continue, despite dubious motives, to steer clear of any commercial segments deemed sensitive by Chinese authorities. In other words, through some combination of luck and master planning, China has come through the last quarter of a century spinning free trade and open systems to its advantage. What the West has failed to see is that Chinese companies, unlike their Western counterparts, are imbued with nationalist fervor. Jim tells us that anyone dealing with a major Chinese investor or corporation is in effect dealing with China Inc. It comes with consequence. Let's pick it up there when I ask McGregor if China is to blame for the current state of affairs.
I'm saying don't demonize China. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, hey, nice job. You know, China had a nice run. They were able to take advantage of the WTO and America's dysfunction and America getting completely tied up in wars in the Middle East and focused on terrorism, while China built its economy and okay. And you had a good run, but now we recognize where you sit and where we sit. We need to realign. This isn't demonizing. It's not war. It's not anti-China. It's just saying, okay, let's bring things back into balance because it's not a war. Yeah. And let's keep treating it like a war because China's very much zero-sum game. We want to control all these industries. You know, they're treating it like this is an economic war also. And that's not what this is.
This is the problem we face. How does the U.S., on the one hand, create reasonable and transparent defenses to shield its own interests while at the same time exploring new ways to re-energize American commercial interests? Should American organizations, like those in China, think and act deliberately in the interest of the United States? Or have many U.S. companies passed the point of no return, engaging the world, as the term suggests, as borderless and nationless, quote-unquote, multinationals? Is it not so much a trade imbalance, but rather a corporate cultural schism that now divides China Inc. from all others? McGregor recalls a comment made several years ago in describing GE. Let's pick up the conversation there.
Yeah, you know, look, Jeff Immelke gave a speech a couple years ago where he basically claimed that General Electric really was global. It was stateless. You know, that it was in every country and it worked with every country. And, it, you know, like, and he was saying that's just the way life is today. And he wasn't he wasn't making value judgments. He was just saying, look, we're a business. We're responsible to shareholders. And so we have to deal in every market where we can. I don't think he says this when he's going for tax breaks in Washington, but that's where these companies are stuck now. Right. On who, you know, who do you have your allegiance to? Well, they're running out of the U.S. because our tax system is so bollocksed that they go buy a brewery in Ireland and then claim that that's our headquarters.
which why not?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I mean, we just have to wake up and realign our system. And. And this administration, sadly, is not going to be the one to do it.
And it's a waiting game. And yet, as we're waiting, as you rightly point out, you've got all these industrial zones that are setting up and developing technologies, capabilities, manufacturing competencies for the future. It's 3 years, 4 years that really, we can't spare, can we?
Yes, you betcha.
Yeah.
And then meanwhile, we're running around in circles on Obamacare and, let's see how much, how we can do with our health care and building some stupid ass wall. And China's doing one belt, one road and going around the world. And we're talking about building a wall. I mean, what China should do is go one belt, one road, one wall and build our wall for us.
They have experience in building big walls anyway, don't they? Yeah. Jim, one last piece. I mean, what would you recommend if you were sitting with, the chief trade U.S. trade negotiators? What would be your key advice to them at this point? Even if this administration may not be entirely geared to solve all problems, what could they get done in the near to medium term, and what would you advise them to do?
Well, I'd say quit pretending that coal jobs are coming back, and let's be focused on clean energy and being the leader in that technology. You need to focus on Made in China 2025 and the technologies and high-end manufacturing, artificial intelligence, all those future technologies. We have to make sure America stays the leader in that, and that's gonna require some forms of economic security. So I think we do need a review process on acquisitions, but it's got to be transparent. It can't be CFIUS, where that's about military security. This would be about economic security, and you look at where is the money coming from, who is involved. When after this is bought, what does it mean for American companies that are in other markets competing against them? What kind of fairness is there? Because if they're going to be doing acquisitions in an open market-based system, well, let's make sure that there's something open and market-based about what's going to happen after this acquisition. But make it transparent so it's for all to see, and reporters can write about it, and they can look at this stuff. Don't turn us into the NDRC. Also, I think we need to take a look at the WTO. It's pretty damn dysfunctional now. And how do we get that thing realigned? Because we do need this whole thing on bilateral trade deals. I think there's an attitude in this administration that America is so powerful and mighty that if we only do bilaterals, we are so powerful that others will be weak in the knees and will get good deals. These guys are living in the 1950s.
Well, exactly. It's the old school notion, right?
Yeah. I mean, we're not all that powerful, and we need multilateral trade organizations and multilateral trade deals. And I would tell them, we just rename the TPP, the Trump-Pacific Partnership, rejigger it a bit so he saves some face. And he doesn't, it's not hard for him to say one thing one day and another thing the next day.
Yeah.
The one thing this administration could do is revitalize the TPP and get it done.
Yeah, do you think he understands now, as he's come into the office and gone through this, exactly what the dynamics are and what may be at stake? Or did he not understand before, and perhaps does he understand a little more now about what's in the making?
Well, I mean, what President Trump understands or doesn't understand is who the hell knows? I mean, if we could get the guys on Fox and Friends to talk about TPP, we might be able to gauge that. He does have some smart people around him, but I don't think he reads. I think he's probably got some pretty strong personality disorders that stop him from processing information. So he's just, don't expect him to come up with ideas. You just got to get the people around him to focus and wake up and look at the world the way it is today, not the way it was in 1955.
This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. More with Jim McGregor in just a minute. Welcome back to Inside Asia. I'm Steve Stein. My guest is China expert Jim McGregor, and we've been talking about U.S.-China trade and, among other things, the consequences of American short-sightedness when it comes to dealing with China. As McGregor points out, the U.S. withdrawal from the TPP agreement is just one example of American myopia. In my previous episodes, if you haven't had a chance to listen to, you can find it along with other episodes on www.insideasiapodcast.com. Jim compares the ramifications of the TPP withdrawal to the war in Iraq. We're not talking about war, of course, but we are talking about policy shortfalls and the undermining of U.S. interests. Remove yourself from the field of battle, whether it be military or economic, and you risk loss of influence. Let me put it another way. The Chinese trade and market access dilemma is nuanced. There are layers of intrigue, rules and exceptions that have allowed the Chinese to gain ground legitimately, by the way. It's a game of chess, but Trump, he doesn't play chess. He plays lawn darts. And that's the game that North Korea is now playing with the U.S. Mount a nuclear device atop a long-range missile and aim it towards the U.S., and by God, you'll get the attention of this U.S. president. It's unfortunate, but not all that surprising, that North Korea, not China, dominates the Trump agenda, if you can say he has an Asia agenda at all. It's important to give this some historical perspective, and it harkens back to the 1950s when the U.S. armed forces rallied in support of South Korea. When U.S. troops drove north, China under Mao saw this as a direct threat to China, and Mao countered the move by sending Chinese troops to the Korean Peninsula in support of the North. The rest is history. 64 years later, a thin strip of land divides North and South Korea. It's less than a 30-minute drive from the South Korean capital of Seoul. For China, North Korea is, and has always been, a bit of a problem child. Beijing has tested its relationship with various forms of discipline, ranging from trade restrictions to curtailment of humanitarian aid to diplomatic warnings. It can be argued that all efforts have had little effect. For China, and other countries for that matter, as long as Pyongyang's line of eccentric leaders kept to themselves, no one really cared much. When Kim Jong-un came to power in 2011, however, he upped the ante by doubling down on his long-range missile program, emerging in recent months as a viable nuclear threat. Against this backdrop, Trump might have thought it reasonable to ask the Chinese President Xi Jinping to step in and tell Pyongyang to cease and desist. In fact, Trump may have returned to the U.S. from China in January, believing his bidding would soon be done. When in July, however, two North Korean missile tests proved that the rogue nation was suddenly capable of striking U.S. soil, Trump, perhaps not knowing what else to do, blamed the Chinese. I asked Jim to give us his perspective on the situation and asked, if anything, what the Chinese might do to influence North Korea. Is it fair, reasonable, or even logical for the U.S. to weigh in so heavily on Chinese supposed influence over Pyongyang? And does it make sense to threaten trade sanctions if Beijing doesn't intervene?
Well, number one, it's asinine to mix trade discussions with China and America and mix that with North Korea. Completely asinine. It makes no sense.
Why do you think that was done?
Because it's President Trump.
Okay. So there was really nothing beneath that?
No, I don't think there's any deep strategy there. It's just him, you know, him trying to do a real estate deal in the Upper East Side or something. You know, who knows what goes through his head, but that was crazy. North Korea, there's not much. North Korea is an impossible situation for everybody. The Chinese don't look at it like we do. You know, what was the Korean War, you got to remember, in China was called the war to resist America and protect Korea. It was a war with America. And Mao's son died in that war. And they always said they were Chun Shi Aida Guanxi. They always had were as close as lips and teeth. So China's not going to be able to disavow these guys. They also...
It's a historical pledge. It's kind of a moment of devotion to saying, we remember this, we were in this together, we won't let you down on this. But the world has changed, and the world changes everywhere. There must be some policymakers within Chinese government that are starting to think differently about this.
Oh, I think they all think quite differently about it, but the party is the party. Yeah. And the party has a trouble violating its past. Mm. But the more practical issue is, North Korea to them is like their crazy drunken uncle under the staircase, so they try to keep locked up, and he comes out all the time because they don't like this guy, but all they want is a status quo, so they got a buffer between America and their border. I mean, they just look at his, if he collapsed, South Korea takes over, they've got America on their border,
right.
Full stop.
Yeah.
And so I don't think they, look, they don't want him to have a nuke, but it's not their foremost concern because they don't think it's going to be turned on them. And I think they also look at him, he's a bit like, well, you know, look what happened to Gaddafi when he gave up his nuclear program. He was dead 3 years later. The problem is this guy, I don't think this guy is dumb at all. I think he's just inexperienced. So he's doing 85 missile tests instead of 5 and being way too aggressive.
Yeah.
But, you know, he must be know with something he's doing. He's been able to kill all his relatives that could threaten him, including the guy who was close to China.
So you think that they're just as distraught and concerned and at their wit's end with North Korea as we are in the U.S.?
But they look at it differently.
Yeah.
And it feels that it's that black and white, too. It's kind of like it is what it is. You can't really change that. You know, watch the guy carefully, make sure he doesn't really start World War III. But in the meantime, don't ask me to get overly involved. That's just kind of that's the party line.
Well, I mean, look, if they do too much, they destabilize him and that regime collapses.
Yeah.
And they've never been able to incentivize these guys. So they used to take his father and his grandfather and say, hey, look, look what we got going in Shenzhen and look what we got going in Shanghai. Why don't you try this? And apparently he is doing some economic reforms there quietly right now. So I read a story about this recently. I don't know. I'm not an expert on North Korea. What the U.S. wants China to do is to choke North Korea into submission. Mm. And they know if they try doing that, they're going to destabilize a place and they're going to have a mess on their hands. America, on the other hand, can't do much because if we did any kind of a military action, Seoul is surrounded by artillery and missiles. They could just wipe out big parts of Seoul in an hour.
Right.
And so we're both stuck in different ways.
And sanctions won't apply. Somebody said that the trade between China and North Korea actually rose considerably in the first part of this year, so that there doesn't appear to be any effort. Now, whether that's the right answer or wrong answer to try to control North Korea is a different question. What do you think?
I think China is stuck as America is in a different way.
Mm.
I mean, they don't like this guy any more than we do. They just want stability there. And they can't do much. Yeah, they've made some, you know, trying to give this guy some signals, but they can only go so far. And what's Russia doing? You know, I mean, I've read about Russian oil going into North Korea. I've read about where's all this technology for all? I mean, these missile systems he's doing are very different systems, and you read the experts, and they say it's Soviet designs.
Beginning somewhere.
Well, you know, Putin likes to stir up everybody. And, you know, Putin's goal is to stir up the world and keep everybody off balance because he's got a bit of a mess on his hands. Yeah.
But there's a different relationship between Russia and North Korea. I mean, they wouldn't have the same, in theory, the same leverage as would China, would they, because of that historical context you just suggested?
No, I think my guess is Russia would be trying to keep it unstable and to keep the U.S. and China both kind of on pins and needles.
Right.
All right. Crystal ball, 3 years out. What's it going to look like with North Korea, China, Soviet Union, or Russia and the United States?
Well, I have no idea, actually. My assumption is it'll be a lot like it is today because it's been like this for a long time. But who knows? We have an unstable administration in America and an unstable administration in North Korea. So God knows.
Yeah. So it could be just one of those kind of tit for tat, you know, for in perpetuity, or it could be a moment, a crisis when, you know, the world's called to task.
Donald Trump is a commander in chief of the American Armed Forces. And we met with Richard Armitage in Washington recently, and I asked him, I said, what happens if Trump orders the military to say, let's go into Iran, what do you do? He goes, if you're the Joint Chiefs, you do it or you resign. I mean, the Commander-in-Chief has a lot of power, and Donald Trump is our Commander-in-Chief.
There it is.
Enough said.
Yeah. Jim, I know you're packing your bags to go back to Minnesota for a long stay by your lakeside cabin, if I'm not mistaken, contemplating these bigger issues. I thank you for taking time out and speaking with us today.
Oh, I'm glad to do it. Glad to do it. It's fun to see you again.
Speak soon. Bye-bye. That was Jim McGregor, China trade expert and senior corporate advisor. As frequent listeners will know, I sometimes like to conclude shows with something we call a bungkus, which in Bali is a quick, wrapped takeaway meal. After a couple of slices of Jim McGregor, I'm thinking a bungkus is in order. A little tying up of things, perspective, if you will, on what to make of our conversation spanning two back-to-back episodes. Frankly, it's complicated. China remains a bit of an enigma. The world is largely blind to China's policy and decision-making process, and it's therefore hard to know how much of our present circumstances are by luck or design. Sometimes the most complex things are resolved, or at least partially explained, with a story. One comes to mind from my upbringing in Tennessee. Of course, at the time of its telling, I wasn't thinking about U.S.-China relations, but I think of it now. You may know it. It's about a rabbit and a crocodile. Stories like this have been around forever, and that's because they tell us something true about the world as it is. It begins with the rabbit and the crocodile meeting at the edge of a wide river. The rabbit looks longingly at the opposite bank, but sees no way of crossing. The crocodile, seeing this, glides up along the bank. "You look troubled, my friend. Can I be of assistance?" asks the crocodile. "I need to cross this river, but the current is too strong, and I don't swim," replies the rabbit. "Then hop aboard my snout and I'll see you safely across." The rabbit, knowing little about the crocodile and duly aware of his sharp protruding teeth, naturally hesitates. "Don't be afraid, my friend. I'm at your service," says the croc reassuringly. The rabbit hops aboard and steps to the tip of the croc's snout. The journey is smooth and the crocodile is strong and agile. However, just as they approach the far bank, the crocodile opens his mouth and snaps at the rabbit, grazing his ear. Alive but shocked, the rabbit turns and exclaims, "What do you think you're doing?" "I'm going to eat you," says the croc. "You called me friend," says the rabbit. "We are friends," says the croc. "But what do you expect? I'm a crocodile." It's easy to see the rabbit as foolish and self-serving. But on the other hand, why shouldn't he trust the crocodile? The rabbit had no reason to believe the croc was offering anything other than a ride, and that served his purposes, at least at the moment. It's a free market, after all. If the croc had offered a ride, but at an exorbitant price, perhaps the rabbit would have declined. In hindsight, the rabbit should have been more careful. He should have done his homework, studied the nature of crocs, understood the rules of engagement, learned about the creature's diet and eating habits. Based on this, the rabbit should have established guidelines, not just for his own passage and safety, but for the passage and safety of all future rabbits. Here's the thing. Rabbits like Americans are largely open-minded and trusting of an open system that honors the basic rules of engagement. They trust the open market. If a croc offers passage to another market, why not take it? What do you have to lose? The ride is free after all, right? Wrong. Nothing in life is free, as the story goes. This is a long way of saying that the U.S. has to do something now about the imbalance in U.S.-China trade and correct where it can the inequities that exist with respect to mutual market entry. McGregor warns us, if we ignore his advice, it's at our own peril. Now is the time to put into place a comprehensive, transparent review process in the hopes of establishing a level playing field. The so-called Fourth Industrial Revolution is upon us, and if you consider that China now serves as the world's largest single manufacturing hub, then know this. The mainland will do everything in its power to consolidate its grasp on the future of manufacturing and control of our global supply chains. They see the hope and promise of robotics, big data analytics, and artificial intelligence, and they will spare no expense, nor will they miss an opportunity to leverage their trading partners to gain control of the technologies required to catapult them into the next level of economic prowess. The world is being taken for a ride, complacent in the belief that on the far bank lie new and expansive markets, an elixir for future economic growth. But the crossing can be treacherous, and the temptation to take that free ride is tempting. Pay the porter, I say, and know the difference between he who serves versus he who would be served. Until next week, this is Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia. Thanks for listening.